I will talk mainly about the Center for Historical Reenactments, which co-founded in Johannesburg last year, 2010. So it's a very new project in the space. But also I'd like to give some context of where this idea comes from. I spent 2 or 18 months in New York not so long ago, and this was also during the time of the campaign of Barack Obama. And during this time, there was this term that kept on coming up or cropping up, which was called rope a dope. And so a friend of mine and I, we decided that we are going to create or recreate this boxing match between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, which happened to happen in Zaire in 1974, October. And mainly because the term rope a dope actually came out of that time or that match. And this is the method that Ali used to win the fight, and it was called rope a dope because he let Foreman beat him up until, you know, Foreman was tired because Foreman was stronger. And then on the eighth round he came stronger and that was a rope a dope moment. And this was coming up again and again in when I was in America, because this method of campaigning was also likened to a rope-a-dope moment. And so we became interested in actually that moment in 1974 where African Americans were also, there was this kind of going back home or looking at Africa as a spiritual home and also looking at dictatorships, you know, Mobutu's time in 1974 in Zaire, and him having sponsored this boxing match for $10 million. And like, what did this mean? What, you know, and the promises that were around in Zaire at the time, in Kinshasa, and, you know, kind of this bloom, and also this two American boxers going to fight in Zaire. And at the same time, there was a music concert that was planned originally to coincide with the boxing match, but it had to happen before the boxing match because Foreman got injured. And so we spoke to two artists who kind of, you know, provided two performances that were thinking about the concept of this rope a dope, and also, and so we started to think about rope a dope as a strategy, an artistic strategy, a curatorial strategy, a strategy to win a losing war. And from this idea we thought, oh, you know, we're gonna go back to South Africa and start the Center for Historical Reenactments. And also working within this framework, which is very open but at the same time very important, was very important for me going back to Joburg, because I had left out of a frustration and wanted, you know, time to think. And this time for thinking actually produced these kinds of ideas. So I would refer to the center as CHR from now on, because it's quite a mouthful. So I mean, the main questions that we ask as CHR is, what are the relations between art and history? How can art contextualize history and vice versa? How can it affect, alter or comment upon how we receive and view history, and suggest different historical readings that help in the formation of new subjectivity? As CHR, we also don't aim to look at discourses of locality or cultural specificity per se, but rather to investigate what artistic and cultural tools, what modes of criticism are used in the presentation of these discourses. For instance, how ethnic, racial, linguistic, and gendered struggles in a given context are presented in a global narrative? What will be the role of art practitioners to contextualize these specific cities without reallocating Eurocentric signifiers? And what you see in the photograph is actually seen through the window. If it's in the publication of this project, you see that I have a text inside, which is titled, "Does This Window Have a Memory?" So for us, this window is actually the most important part of the space in which we look outside and try to reflect on some aspects of it. And so the space actually launched with a talk by Unji Jun from the View Museum, curator of education and public programs, as well as a performance by Kimani Walihulere, who is also is a member of CHR, and he presented a reenactment of the rehearsal. But the project that I would like to talk mostly about is this project, which is called Xenoglossia, a research project. It is a research project. And just to break down the term itself, xenoglossy is actually a condition, a contested condition, where somebody speaks in a language that they've never heard, speaks or writes in a language that they've never heard, never came into contact with. It's and it's mostly explained under it's usually explained using actually another contested phenomena, which is reincarnation. And we're actually looking at thinking about different historical events, but also prompted by one historical, not so historical, but one event, which was the 2008 in May, there was this violence attack that was directed towards Africans of other nationalities, which was spoken about as xenophobia. I would like to perhaps even think about it as Afrophobia. And for us, there was this frustration of the language that was used by the media to actually talk about this event, and it kind of became too pathological, and it really didn't give us possibilities to reimagine different futures, you know, how to work around this issue. So, but not only that, the project also considers events such as the 1976 Soweto student uprisings, historical protests against Afrikaans as a language in institutions and schools, and also words like kwere kwere, which is actually a word which attempts to mimic a sound of an unrecognized language rather than a word in itself, and in one which these misunderstandings can best be located within a South African context. So xenoglossia, the meaning of it is strange language or foreign language. We also go as far as considering Caliban, retort to Prospero and Miranda in William Shakespeare's The Tempest. "You taught me your language, and my profit on it is that I know how to curse." A slogan which has come to be used as a tool of cultural resistance and described by Bill Ashcock as an evocative model of the post-colonial subject. So, some of the questions that we ask with this project is, how has the manipulation of language historically constructed narrowed concept of identity, difference, and otherness? How can how can Ernestine White's work and statement, "I do not speak Xhosa," exist alongside Greg Mary's work, "The mantra I must learn is to speak Xhosa"? What codes are embedded within these two positions, and what do these works reveal about post-apartheid tensions and emotional sites of cultural identities? Another question would be, does Mladen Stinovic, who's a Croatian artist, statement and work an artist who cannot speak English is no artist, help highlight the fact that the global art world we so often refer to cannot handle a clearly multicultural world? How can Hito Styles essay and question, can the subaltern speak German, whose title is a phrase from Gyatis, Beatles, can the subaltern speak, help us to trace the disparities in post-colonial political positioning pertaining to languages? How can context and language construct both memory and meaning? Can meaning be constructed without a definition? So these are some of the questions that I asked. I'd like to go back a bit. So what you see there is an ongoing performance. The project itself, we planned it for 6 months, so it started in November 2010, and the idea was that it would last for 6 months, but this is becoming impossible because the more we go deeper into this question or these questions, the more we find that it's interesting actually to work with and bring to the fore. But so we have different events. We've had three so far, and the last one was on the 27th of May this year. So this one was in November in the start, and it started with this performance by the Namnom Collective, Demakukama and Kimang Walihulere, who are also both members of CHR, the Unknowing Grammar of Inhabiting a Text. It's based on a short story by Kimang, and thinking about how to bring this into the performances. So it's a work in progress. That happens each time we have an event. I don't know how it's going to turn out. And we've also shown a work by Tracy Rose, not a work actually, but a documentation of a performance that she did in Spain in 2006, whose translation, she did it in Spanish. It's titled, Can You Breastfeed Here? In Spanish, and it was, she wrote a script in English and then had it translated into Spanish and was reading the script. Of course, she does not speak Spanish, so a translator was arranged for her who was speaking real Spanish. And based on the book, they came before Columbus, looking at the African presence in Europe and the intention of that presence historically. So you see a proposal on the right, or the work that will perhaps follow the performance by the Non-Non Collective. And these are some of the works that we kind of think about as well. So we kind of take these works and photocopy them and put them in the space. So the space itself is activated by works that we find that are relevant to the project. And also, of course, this issue of translation and interpretation. We were thinking actually about the very first interpreters, or what people would call the native informants, and what was happening, what would happen in this act of translating. So actually, I've taken a very small part of Louis Nkosi, who was a South African writer who recently passed away. His very first book, which is titled Mating Birds, which is set at the beach in Durban between a black man and a white woman. And these beaches were separated, so there was a part for black people and a part for white people. And the story is told by the men in prison waiting to be hanged for raping the white woman. And there's this very interesting part in the book that, you know, that made me, I think it's really hilarious, but at the same time, you know, It's quite, it made me think about this act of translating. So it's a court scene, and I will read from this. "Orgies," Veronica repeated, the faintest hint of a smile curved her upper lip. "What sort of orgies? I've never participated in any orgies in my whole life." Although I had adequate knowledge of English, it was the unalterable law of the South African courts that whenever a native stood trial, an interpreter had to be provided in order to translate into an African language the minutest details of the proceedings. But in this instance, the African brother who made the most valiant attempts to render into my native Zulu tongue all that was being said in English soon experienced difficulties. The tangled web of erotic perversion woven into the evidence soon became too much for him to comprehend, let alone translate into another language. "Orgies?" the interpreter repeated uncertainly. "Your lordship, there is no word for orgies in the Zulu language." "Good gracious, man, are you trying to tell the court that your people had never heard of orgies before white men came to this continent?" Justice de Klerk made the question sound like an indictment. The interpreter, who was standing next to me, supposedly in order to translate what was being said, looked crestfallen. I took the opportunity to save him from further embarrassment by leaning over the dog and whispering into his ear, "Ama-ojismos, ulako behlana kona belugu begama bonke bephuzana ngomlomo njengezinja." The interpreter at first looked flabbergasted. Quite likely he suspected that I was playing him in a seemingly joke. He looked around him hesitantly as if to appeal for aid. Then, presumably deciding to throw all caution to the wind, he gave the court a wild, foolish grin and then stood facing the African gallery. The big bus asked if the madam was in the habit of visiting a certain house where everybody ate and drank everyone else, copulating like dogs as if there was no tomorrow. He finished clicking the tongue, and from the galleries to the left, the Africans gave a collective murmur like a slow buzz of many disturbed bees. The women pressed their infants closely to their bosoms, as if they feared such talk might affect them adversely in later life in some yet undetermined way. So, that's Louis Gross. And so we started to think about also this book, which was written by a man called Magema Magwaza Fuze in 1922, which is the very first book that was written in Zulu language. And Magema Fuze was one such interpreter who was working with the Bishop of Natal at the time, Bishop Colenso. And how also this group of people, including Magema Fuze, they fashioned themselves as intellectuals and actually had to write this book, which is what's titled in Zulu, Abantu Abamnyama Bavela Khona, or The Black People and Whence They Come, which was a translation in 1979. And what the writer here, Sonipa Mokoena, has done is actually look at the book, look at the translation, and also Magema Fuze's life and know what that time meant, and created the book Magema, or wrote the book Magema Fuze, The Making of the Color Intellectual, which is brings back this the life of this man and the book itself and the translation, of course, and kind of looks at the mistranslations as well, or the untranslatable in the English version. And we had one event of Xenoglossa was actually the book launch of Hlonipho Mokoena and the conversation with Kwezi Kunye. And our very last event on the 27th of May thus far, we screened a film by Moni Fatmi, which is titled The Beautiful Language from 2010. And we also think about commissioning new work, and so we have this two commissions on either side, one by Nota Nathis as a very young artist, and it's actually more a proposal, that's what it is. So she proposes to do something, and first, when you saw the window, the first light, that was the first part of the proposal, the drawing, and this is the second part of the proposal. And so in September, we'll do the third part of the proposal. And also, a photograph by Zanele Mkhoyi, maybe a performance photograph as well, which is taken from Zanele, who goes around Johannesburg and collects and there's this very growing second-hand cloth market that is growing in Johannesburg. It's growing, it's sort of new compared to other African countries, and it's kind of taken over the whole street, and each person is dealing in a different, you know, parts of clothing, and she was collecting these underwears, which also come from the West, second-hand underwears. And she's been collecting this, and it's kind of forming this pile and presenting it in an exhibition in a way that actually, like, talking to her was not quite working for what, you know, this gesture of these underwears coming from the West would actually mean. And I, you know, we sort of talked about how we could bring this back to the West somehow and also bring it home. So issues of cultural translation as well are very much part of the project. So, and so we thought about the Arte Povera movement in Italy, and actually this very seminal work by Michelangelo Pistoletto, The Venice of the Rags. And so what she did is kind of pile up these underwears and mimic the pose of this statue that is in front also of the pile of rags of Michelangelo, which is an installation, and this work exists as a photographic, like, it's meant to also exist as a wallpaper. So this was our very first commissioning. Ah, okay. Fine, sorry. It's in the publication. So the space actually exists also like this, in thinking about how we can intervene into the larger art scene, and also and talking with artists directly about how to find other ways of translating ideas and, you know, and bringing them to the space. And it's also that frustration, because when the xenophobic attacks, the Afrophobic attacks happen, that the responses that we are around, they were not giving us possibilities or a position in which to construct other kinds of futures. And they merely became formulations that left little room or no room in which to construct a more enabling vision in a way about one's cultural inheritance. And what we were wishing for is, during this time, I think what we wanted to embrace is a kind of difficulty or complexity that is needed to understand what it means to live and think and create in South Africa. An essay by a writer, South African writer, Ashraf Jamal, kept on kind of cropping up, which is called The Variable Likeness of Tracy Rose's Case, in which he writes about the South African condition. And in some parts of it, he says, South Africa is a country that invariably destroys the claims of those who attempt to explain it, or worse, to explain it away. And he asks this very important question for us: how then to commemorate? Where does one begin? And then he goes, the fact is one doesn't. For South Africa, irrespective of history, of the history it has constructed for itself, remains a society that lives with the terrible unease of never having begun. It may suppress this unease. Indeed, it would seem that South Africa's finest talent is its ability to draw a rabbit out of a hat and call it history. And which is why also this title of Center for Historical Reenactments, because I think there is a sense of amnesia that keeps on happening, like things are filed quite too soon. And I think if we were able to actually learn from history, not just South African history, history of the world, post-colonial histories. Perhaps we would have a better language to talk about this. Perhaps there would not even be this event that happened, because I think there's many examples where, you know, post-colonial conditions, they come to this kind of eruption. So for us, actually, the project Xenoglossa is kind of an intervention into this. This lack of complexity in the whole issue, and I like when Ashraf Jamal says South Africa does destroy the claim of those who attempt to explain it or explain it away. It's a very complex country to live in, and I think our solutions need to be simple in a very also complicated way, and not just this or that, but to find another zone in which to think about issues. And so our examples are not just South African, they are drawn from different realities, and also, I'm sorry about the photographs, they really come out dark. And also, you know, kind of presenting these possibilities in terms of the archives that we collect and the books. And readings. And one actually moment in which people of my generation and those who are younger than me that we kind of missed, I think I missed it slightly, is the Johannesburg Biennale that does not exist anymore. So I think also South Africa kind of exists with this phantom pain of this limp that, you know, was so important, and now it's no longer there. If, you know, everywhere I go, people ask about the Johannesburg Biennale. Johannesburg Biennale was one of the most important exhibitions of the 1990s. And for us, the question is that what happened? And somehow there's no answer to this. It's very hard to, you know, for people to actually say what happened. And so we're actually also thinking about different ways of bringing back that moment and reenacting it in different ways, and not based on an archive, because also there is no archive, but on more the social archive and stories that people tell around, you know, especially the 1997, the second version of the Biennale. So we have a catalogue, which is a catalogue of who was around rather than the work that was shown. So the photographs that are in the catalogue are basically, you know, old work. They might not be the work that was shown. And also the catalogue has different essays. And in one of these essays is an essay by Julia Christopher, by What Rights Are You a Foreigner? And we thought, like, but these issues were already there in 1997. And these questions of that time are still important for us to ask now. So let's bring them back. So this is a way actually that we kind of reenact this moment of the Biennale. So I think also we're making a Biennale in a way, or remaking it, but not in a very spectacular way, and with no budget whatsoever. We just photocopy everything, and we have a black wall so that we are able to actually write on it. It's not the white cube, black cube, could be pink. And yeah, just creating these possibilities, I think first there's a growing audience and a recognition of, you know, of, and the need for this space, because I think we're the only alternative platform that does not do exhibitions. So we don't do exhibitions. We are more interested in processes and processes of thinking about things that are so. Yeah. Thank you.
No, I thought it could be an opportunity for questions, of course. A short one, probably. And then we come to one time for the question after Hansi's presentation.
Thanks. So I would like to know, you start already making joke by how would you contextualize conceptualize your work within Johannesburg, within South Africa, within Southern Africa, maybe also I think it's now a very globalized art slash social cultural world. Would you like to relate to that, or is it not of importance?
To relate to what?
To contextualize your work within, let's say, very local, national and transnational situation. So how do you see yourself? Because I'm quite sure that you're traveling a lot, but you're also based locally. And how you relate to that? The work you're doing, or your projects.
Thanks. I think what during my presentation I was stressing also is that we're not local or context specific per se, but of course the space is in Johannesburg and there's a reality, which is why the window becomes for us the point of reference actually into these realities. And so the project is very much also an intervention to the local art scene and local questions. But in terms of how we attempt to answer these questions, we look everywhere for answers and bring them back to reflect on this local situation. So yes, I do get to travel here and there, and for me it's really always important to go back to Johannesburg and think some more about these issues. For example, the next project that we will do will be an intervention at the Hector Peterson Museum, which is in Soweto, and the Hector Peterson Museum is a museum that kind of commemorates that June 16 moment of the uprising. And the display is really, for us, a flex, if I may say. You know that there was an intention, but you don't know what has happened between the intention and the outcome of this display. We cannot touch the display, of course, but and for us, we don't want to touch the display, but to intervene in a different way. And for this, we're looking at street languages, actually, so it's, which is very much also based in Afrikaans. And so that project will be called Valkas J, which is an Afrikaans way we knew. But also it's a title of a song, quite a song that actually comes from Soweto itself. So you can see how the people have kind of taken this language, Afrikaans, and many other languages, and reformulated them to use and abuse. So, And the project in September actually is a project that is based on the window, that can be seen from the window rather than people come. I mean, people come inside to look out of the window to see the project in a roof that is just opposite. So of course it's, you know, the local is very important, but also I think there's a lot to learn from other histories.